Welcome to the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee. We have Ventum Bikes and Trainer Road's Ivy Audrain with us today, and we are going to talk about Unbound Gravel. It just happened. We're going to talk about fat adaptation as well. Lots of good stuff to talk about on this episode. Before we get into it, if you are listening to this podcast or watching this podcast and you don't subscribe to our Instagram channel, which you can do, just go over to Instagram and follow us. That's how you do that. You'll miss a great video by Ivy if you don't do that, that she just put up about how to adjust your plan when you're sick. Ivy, I think that is, I was just looking the other day. I don't know the exact number because we've had many different iterations of questions, but we are in the hundreds of thousands of questions that have been submitted to the podcast, certainly somewhere in the hundreds, which is just crazy when you think of that. Mm-hmm. And this has to be the most common question is, what do I do when I'm sick? And of course, as you can hear, I'm sick too. And I apologize for that if it annoys anybody, but is what it is. Ivy, can you, I guess, go ahead and like spoiler your video a little bit for folks, but like kind of explain what you did in the video, because it's probably the most common question we get to the podcast.
Yes, Trainer Road created a feature for you so that you don't have to guess what to do or engineer what to do when you get sick or injured or travel for vacation, especially with things like illness when we're not sure how long we're going to be sick. Like, John, do you know how much time to put in off right now in your calendar?
Remember when I told you after the first day it was a sore throat? I was like, I'll be all good tomorrow. I got a beat. And now it's like 6 days of like being on my deathbed. Yeah.
Do you think you pushed it maybe? Do you think you?
Oh, 100%. It was so foolish of me. Yes. Yeah, it was very bad. And it wasn't pushing it with training. It was pushing it with just like going through life. Life is challenging in and of itself. And I just didn't put the brakes on it. Yeah, I didn't know how long I was going to be sick. So
So with Trainer Road, with annotations, you can put in time off, and you can preset little color coded categories for a work trip, for vacation, for injury, illness, whatever. And then it's really easy to edit those as you go along when you're like, I'm still not feeling great. I need a couple more days. And Adaptive Training knows what's happening, sees what you're putting in, looks at the full scope of what you did before you got sick, how long you've been sick, when your last workout was, that you're putting in more time and adjust accordingly so that you're appropriately eased back into training.
Yeah, it's awesome. So if you want to get information like that, because this podcast only comes out once a week, we've tried making it more than once a week, like releasing it more frequently. And some of you didn't like it. And also like the average listens went down. So we stay at one time a week. But if you want to get more content and more information like that and get it quickly, you can do it. Just go over to our Instagram channel and check it out. You can follow us on TikTok as well. We'll post those videos over there so you can see it. But Ivy and Sarah are producing awesome content all the time that you can see me occasionally as well. So go check that out. Okay. I want to have a discussion really quick about Unbound, this year. And I'm not going to talk about like, okay. So a lot of mud happened, if people don't know, and a lot of athletes are posting about it and people are saying like, I'm so tired of seeing all your muddy bikes. I don't care.
Wait, really
talk about that.
After seeing all this and knowing how it went down, are you still going to do it next year?
I'm somehow more excited about it.
Oh my goodness.
I know. I don't know what's happened to me, but I'm like, I have zero illusions about placing well at Unbound. Like it won't happen. But I'm really excited to take on that challenge. Just to finish that thing looks tough. Like for example, I still don't know what bike I'm going to ride. And the reason that I don't know what bike I'm going to ride is because a lot of bikes, gravel bikes aren't a SRAM universal derailleur hanger or UDH compatible yet. Mm-hmm. And I want to run the new SRAM transmission there with the XO derailleur, not the XX or the XXSL, because the XO derailleur has a metal pulley cage instead of a carbon pulley cage.
That's right. Like,
that race is all about durability. And I can't count how many derailleurs, SRAM and Shimano, that I saw twisted and broken because of going through the mud and the grass and getting stuff caught in there and then trying to push through it.
Well, this is why you should race single speed.
Yeah.
This is fair, the purity fair point, but of terrible single point. Speed.
Yeah. But I'm going to switch. And also like with the transmission shifting under load, it's better with that sort of situation too. Less likely to snap a chain, chain's more durable. I just think it's a better choice. It's just a lot of money. And I'll have to kind of space it out. I have everything built out in a spreadsheet on like cost per gram per part of all the whole transmission thing. Of course I do. And so I kind of have a plan of what I need to build up, but
Yeah, Send Simon into the coal mine.
The goal is just to get through.
Yeah. Got the black. Put him to work. He's ready.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm excited to do it. And I think it's about durability and perseverance and getting through it. And on that note, before we get into just this kind of like fun discussion on some things you can do to go faster there, so many of you reached out and shared your experiences to just with me personally on Instagram about how great the race was because of your training with Trainer Road and how you made it through everything because of advice from Ivy and others on the podcast about like how to like keep a cool head in a crazy race scenario. And that's just awesome. Like that, like, fills me with joy and satisfaction to know how many of you had such a great day and we could help in some way with that. So that's why we do all this. It's why we do Trainer Road. We just want to make you faster because faster is more fun on the bike. So if you did Unbounds and you use Trainer Road to do it, can you send us a note at trainerroad.com/podcast where you submit like your questions for the podcast? Tell us your story of how it went. It would be awesome to hear from you because I want to put these together, then share them with our employees and share them with other people too, because I think it's super motivating. But first things first, I want to get to like the course here and describe it. And then I want to talk about how, different things where you can like save time in different scenarios that are kind of surprising on how much time you would or wouldn't save for that. So it was about 206 miles, the course, and about 9,000 feet of climbing. So that's probably somewhere around 3,000 meters, I think, is what they ended up climbing. And what is that, like 400 Ks? Or 330 Ks, I think it is. 330 Ks, something like that. So big day. And it was super muddy and super slow. I'm not going to be talking about a muddy scenario. I'm just going to be talking about with using best bike split. It's just like a normal scenario. Let's say that you are a 250 watt FTP athlete at 170 pounds or 77 kilograms. And you're, that puts you at like 3.24 watts per kilogram. And you had like a capacity day. Like you had the best day because you fueled well, you did all that other stuff. Okay. If you did that, theoretically, without mud, without anything else, remember, this is like normal conditions without mud. Theoretically, you could get to the finish line at 12 hours and 49 minutes. This is with like a standard gravel bike that I think that weighs like 20 pounds I added in. And then like with spares, I added on 6 pounds of spares as well. So 6 pounds between like water and spares and all that stuff. Okay. With all of that, if you draw, and this is going to illustrate some really important things to keep us on track, particularly with weight. I think that all of us feel like, man, if I drop some weight, I would go so fast because 9,000 feet of climbing is a lot. Like it adds up over the course of the day. If you had lost 1 pound, keep in mind that it's 12 hours and 49 minute finish. If you had lost 1 pound, that saves you only 53 seconds. If you had lost 5 pounds, that's 5 minutes and 19 seconds. If you lost 10 pounds, that's 10 minutes and 35 seconds. And all of us are probably thinking like, holy cow, I need to lose 10 pounds, but hold your horses here and listen to what happens when you change your power. If you had just increased your power by 1 watt, that would have given you a 1 minute and 27 second drop off your time.
That's crazy.
So compare that. Losing 1 pound, 53 seconds. Increasing your power output by 1 watt over that course, 1 minute and 25 seconds or 27 seconds savings. That's a lot. So we're talking like 150% if you're looking at 1 pound to 1 watt, 150% different. And think about like when you're pedaling on your bike and you just put out 1 watt extra, you don't even realize that a lot of the time. So
I think about this all the time for athletes that micro analyze, oh, this interval was at this percentage. And I, you know, what if I did it at 102% instead of 103? And I'm like, brother, when I am doing intervals, like, you know, the variation could be anywhere from like 5 to 10 watts and you don't really feel it or notice it, you know,
like totally. Yeah. I'm typically within like a 10 to 20 watt range. But the difference is I'm not constantly trying to drag my average up. That's a big no-no. And then I'm also not trying to freak out in every second, adjust for what I'm seeing on my numbers.
Yeah.
I lock into like, yeah, right. Like it's you ride and you feel what the power feels like. And then after that, what you do is you then hold on to that feeling and you check in regularly, right? Mm-hmm. To see if your perception of that feeling is drifting.
Depends on the interval, John, but I feel like I do it probably every like 10 or 15 seconds. If it's like a shorter one, maybe. And then if it's a longer one, try to stretch it out to like 30 or 45 and practice like settling in.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. Same for me. And on days when I'm like, some days my perception is more tied in to reality. And sometimes there's some sort of like, you know, issue there. Where like, oh my gosh, I'm going too hard. Or, oh my gosh, I'm going like, I'm not going hard enough. It goes on either side of the fence. And those days I'll check in more often. And then on other days, I just check in less often when I feel like I'm well calibrated, so to speak. You know,
that's validating. So, it makes me feel like there's something wrong with me when I have those wrong perception days. And I feel like I'm just like staring at the head unit because I can't figure it out.
There's like my zero off. I need to zero offset myself too, right? Like it's not just my power meter. So, okay, back to this. If you had increased your average power by 5 watts, it would have saved you 11 minutes and 33 seconds. Keep in mind that if you had lost 10 pounds, it would have saved you 10 minutes and 35 seconds. So just increasing by 5 watts eclipses that already. So this also, when a person goes to drop 10 pounds, oftentimes that sort of an effort, especially if it's close to the event, is going to come at the cost of power. Like you're going to do something that's going to deprive yourself of your muscle mass, or lean mass is likely what's going to get lost there. You might also lose fat mass too, but you're going to lose your ability to perform. So if you lose 10 pounds, but in the same time, you also lose 5 watts, you've actually become slower as a result of this. If you had just stayed at your normal weight, but just increased by 5 watts, you would have become faster. So, and now if you'd increase your power by 10 watts, that would save you 22 minutes and 32 seconds over the course. It really adds up with such a long race, like a small difference compounds when you're talking about that. Now let's talk about drag, which is, I think, the most irrelevant thing that you could possibly come up with at Unbound because of the fact that you're going to look like a mud monster anyway, like that meme when they talk about like the cheese at the bottom of the oven, watching you bake other things. It's just like fried and cracked. Like that's what you look like after Unbound. So like, don't worry about being super aero. If it's going to be muddy, it's all gone. But just for kicks, if you had saved 1 watt of drag, which to give you an idea of like 1 watt of drag, I think that they sometimes equate that to like an inch of cable housing being exposed is roughly equivalent to a watt. Don't quote me on that directly. Look at the specialized wind tunnel. I think they discussed that before. And perhaps that's their perspective when other people have measured it differently. I don't know. But I've heard that before, that like 1 inch of cable is equated to 1 watt. If you had done that, that would say, and you had gotten rid of that, saved 1 watt, that would save you 23 seconds. So this is half of weight. And weight is half of power in terms of the impact it could have. And then if you had saved 5 watts of drag, it would save you 1 minute and 57 seconds. And then if you had saved 10 watts of drag, 3 minutes and 55 seconds. So that's like 10 inches of cable housing, if you're thinking of that. Or I don't know what would save 10 watts, but we're talking probably on the course of like one shaved leg, not two shaved legs or something. So
it's a anyways, bold look.
That's yeah. The Harvey Dent look. If, as you can see, drag also doesn't increase at the same rate, that same linear rate that you're seeing with weight and power. But I'm going to put this in context really quick. So, okay, I've broken this down. You could theoretically save 44 minutes off of this time of 12 hours and 49 minutes. So you could get really close to the 12-hour mark if you did the following. 1 inch of exposed cable housing, roughly about 8 seconds over Unbound. So yeah, it's less than that. Forgive me. It's a lot less. So that's not very much. Clean shaven versus beard would save you roughly 8 seconds over the course of Unbound. So especially gravel people, like, run the beards. Don't worry about it. 8 seconds doesn't matter. Shaved legs, it would save you 9 minutes. But then again, if your legs are covered in mud, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, at all. And your legs are going to get covered in mud in that race. Braided hair versus loose could save you 1.5 minutes. So, and they found that the fastest is a braid, I think, in at least specialized videos that they did. 4 pins versus 8 pins on your number would only save you a minute, theoretically. I'm sure that your mileage may vary. Aero bars versus drops would save you 13 minutes. That said, you would have to ride in your aero bars the whole time, and you know that you're not going to ride in the aero bars, and it's going to compromise your power. If you're riding in your aero bars and you're putting out 10 watts less, then once again, you're probably going to be slower. Baggy kit versus race fit kit is 6 minutes of savings. Skin suit versus your race minute kit is 12 and a half minute savings. Skin suits are like such a huge savings. However, keep in mind, you're going to get covered in mud, and you're going to like probably have a hydration pack on. So this is once again, more or less nullified. Sometimes the hydration pack, I know some people have said the hydration pack tests faster for them. Your mileage may vary. I know that Specialized actually found that it was a wash or slower for a lot of people because of the frontal area and the drag that it could cause. All depends on your lean angle and how open you are or how closed you are. If you're really leaned over, it's probably going to have less impact and may even be beneficial. But if you're more upright, it's probably going to be slower. And then shoe covers versus a normal shoe, 4.5 minutes does not matter because you're going to get covered in mud. And an aero helmet would save you about 5.5 minutes. Once again, you're going to get covered in mud, so it might change. But think about this really quick. So in an optimized scenario, if you had saved 22% of cumulative drag reduction, so all those things added up, it would be 12 hours and 5 minutes would be your race time. But if you had just added 10 watts and you had all that drag decrease, but then added 10 watts, you would drop you down to 11 hours and 45 minutes. And then if you had done that and then, of course, had the 10-pound weight decrease, it could be 11 hours and 34 minutes would be the time that you could drop down to from 12 hours and 49 minutes. So
what you're saying is maybe instead of using equipment that doesn't make sense or it costs a lot of money, you can just train a little bit more.
Yes, honestly, like looking at the biggest return, absolutely is training. Mm-hmm. And the thing is to get more out of your training, you need to fuel effectively, you need to recover effectively, which means doing a training volume that's appropriate for you. Mm-hmm. With an event like this, it's saying no to some of those like fun rides that you want to do sometimes, not all of them, but sometimes you kind of do have to just say like, I'm already pretty high up on training stress this week. Like I probably shouldn't, or it's a recovery week. So I probably shouldn't do that. Like that's the sort of stuff that just adds up time after time and then makes it so that you're there with 5 more watts. And then if you're there with 5 more watts, boom, right there, you're already saving 11 minutes off your day, off your time, which if you're looking at unbounds, probably the biggest motivation to go faster is just to spend less time out there. So,
yeah.
So like, you know,
and when you think about all this stuff that could save you time in terms of drag, like an aero helmet that maybe doesn't ventilate quite as well, or a hydration pack that, I mean, those are pretty necessary, but like, or like a smaller tread tire to run faster, how much more miserable it is and kind of negates any energy that you would save because you're miserable or too hot and you need to like cool yourself more. Like,
yeah,
faster is not always like faster equipment is not always faster in every scenario, you know?
100%. I would love to figure out like the average time for a flat that happened at Unbound this year, because I think that a lot of us make these like tire choices that are running us close to the edge. It makes zero sense. Like you should be thinking about durability for that event in particular, but at any event where there's a question about your tires, it's best to err on the side of durability because a flat, if it is very likely to happen, is just so slow. It's way slower than the time saved that you would have. I know that Keegan, for example, was debating on whether to do refuses, which are slicks, or ramblers. And he chose ramblers, not just because of the mud, but because it gave him more tread, not for traction, but more tread meant more things in between a rock and then puncturing the tire. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, that's an important thing to do. And for those of us that aren't paid, we should absolutely be erring on the side of like better protection so we don't have flats that derail our day. So the race like was ended up being super muddy this year. They had a really muddy section in the beginning that ended up throwing everything off for a lot of people. It sounded like that the smart riders would do Ivy. It's they were riding through the grass instead of riding through the muddy road. I assume that's a good cyclocross technique that you would look for in muddy conditions. Do you look to ride through grass instead of riding in the mud?
Depends. If it's the kind of, if it was where like the road is recessed and that's why it's muddy, and then like the grass is a little bit elevated, like sometimes you can go in the grass and it's just as, it's the same kind of dirt and the same kind of mud, but then you're also in grass and then it starts to get in your drivetrain and that causes a lot of problems. Or if it's like freshly mowed, that like long, you know, like those highway frontage roads have really tall, out of control grass, and every once in a while someone comes in and mows it. And so there's just piles of like foot long, loose cut grass. And so you try to go in the grass and the mud is there also. And then that loose grass gets in and you just create like a click, like a brick in your, in your bike much sooner than if you were just to stay in the mud. So it's tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hard to say.
Yeah. It's hard to know. It's worth though, when you see those scenarios happen, you'll see a lot of people doing things and you'll subconsciously just follow people. Be open in that moment and be aware, and suddenly ask yourself, like, is this the best spot to be? Have I tested out different options? Can I go over there and see what it's like? Can I go over here?
I would try the grass, like go in it for a moment and see, like, is it faster rolling? Am I picking up a bunch of extra grass? If yes, then get back in the road, you know? Yeah, you have to be willing to roll with the punches and that kind of stuff.
It's easy to not, right, Ivy? It's easy to just get caught up in the emotion of the moment and just be like, you're slogging through and you don't even stop to take an external look at yourself in the situation that you're in and think like, oh, could I be doing this differently?
This happens in cyclocross all the time in mud sections, especially when there's any sort of technical or steering element and everyone just decides to slog it out and, like, you know, just barely moving. And you're just like, why am I doing this? Like, I'm just going to get off and run. And all of a sudden you gain like five positions because no one thought to look around and be like, is this the most efficient thing? You know, you just, and it might not even be that you make that decision or think about it. You just follow what other people are doing because, and you're with other fast people. And so you're assuming like, this is the best way. This must be the best thing. It's hard to be like, is doing the different thing right here, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's, I remember that video of you sliding down on your bum going down the hill and like, instead of trying to ride it or walk down it.
Well,
and like,
we all fell down the first lap anyways. And so I was like, I'm not going to, you know,
might as well send it. Yeah. Yeah. That was awesome. I love that clip. Okay. Last thing that I want to say on Unbound, is I want to clarify a bit. Sophia is, Sophia, friend of the podcast. She's been on the podcast before, and right now she's being portrayed as complaining and pretty unfairly, and kind of being attacked by a lot of people about this. And I've seen this narrative around the internet. So when she things that people should know about Sophia, one of the things that makes her so good is she has a gift to be able to see everything and how it can be done better. How every single thing in life can be done better. And it's exhausting to be around sometimes because she's like, hey, Jonathan, you could like make your pizza better by not sprinkling your cheese this way. And it's like, let me live. But like, she just has this gift. And that's what makes her so good as an athlete, among the many other things. And see, she suggested changes for Unbound and for the event that could help it out. She did this that were like in the context of like post-race interviews and in the press conference. And as a result, it was understandably seen as like sour grapes by some people that she got second instead of one. She was, I'm sure that she wasn't happy with getting second, but it wasn't as if she was like dissatisfied. She also gave credit to her competitors and never said anything about like them gaining unfair advantage in any way or anything else. Anyways, she was advocating for the women's race to be held on a separate day. And the reason for this is that, and she had mentioned that last year, like, she felt uncomfortable with the fact that she was drafting with dudes that were not in her category the whole time. But that's just kind of the race, and that's what it is. And there's no rules against it, and that's just what it is. And she did it, but she always said that she kind of like felt like a little like uncomfortable with that. Like, then she wishes that it was just like a women's race, just flat out, and that was it. So she's advocating for the women to race on a different day. She's been doing this for like a year. She's mentioned that. So, and to race on a different day. And then if the concern is that, okay, well, if they do that, then the women are going to take way too long. Some of the race organizers maybe, or people involved with that, I don't know, or maybe just fans have communicated that before. And so her point was like, okay, so maybe we just reduce the distance so that it ends up being close to the same time. Like the women finish at the same time. Mm-hmm. And her motive behind this is that way, if all the women are racing together, it's not going to inflate the average speed of the leaders to the point where, like, if you just get with a group of fast dudes, you can really break away and kind of like have like a supernatural average speed for what the women would have typically, because you're riding with these like ultra fast dudes. Mm-hmm. Said she wants it to be more competitive. And then as a result, perhaps more inviting for pro women to race it, because they're like, 200 miles is really intimidating for anybody to ride. And then when you have to look at it and you're like, oh, and the winner last year held the average speed of the men's group. In most of my races, we never get to do that. Like, she's just trying to find a better way to make it more accessible for people. And that's what she's talking about. So she isn't saying make it shorter to make it easier. She isn't saying make it separated out so that it's like somehow more exclusive. Not at all. She's just trying to find ways to make it better in that regard and better for everybody involved. Yeah.
And I'm sure that's tricky because so many folks, like, you know, see the spirit of gravel for those, you know, for the women racers to be, that's part of the race. And part of the dynamic is like how how long can you hang with the fast dudes, you know? And that's like part of your race strategy. And so I know that there's that side of the argument as well, that people like that part of the race.
Yeah. And it's, so it could continue being that, or she's saying it could be this, and mm-hmm. she's just thinking that it might be more inviting or helpful. And then on the mud section, she had heard, and I believe this is accurate in terms of what's been portrayed across the board, that they had a workaround for that really muddy section that happened at 10 miles, but they decided not to use it. And she was just wondering why they didn't do that, because for her, it was actually a relative advantage because she was able to gain a big advantage in that section. You know, she's got the skills and everything else to make it through that with mountain biking and cyclocross background. She's quite good in that stuff. So it actually helped her. So she's not complaining. If you removed it, it probably would have made it harder on her. But she just looked back in retrospect at like how it affected lots of people. I believe they had like 500 DNFs or something close to that, man, is what they're talking about. For amateurs. So she was looking retrospectively like, man, like, was that necessary if we did indeed have a workaround, and why wasn't that exercised? So that's all she's asking for. And I think that I just want to defend her a little bit. And I know that we don't typically talk about this sort of stuff on the podcast, but I thought it was appropriate. And if you're listening to this podcast now, there's a lot of people attacking her on the internet. And if you just want to go in and show her your support, I think that that would be really cool, because we get this really myopic perspective when people attack us on the internet. I can speak from experience on this. And it's really helpful to sometimes have some people say, hey, that perspective is one perspective, but it isn't the only one. So if you all agree and think that it's good that she's trying to help the sport that she's also racing in, let her know. I think it would be helpful. So, okay, with that out of the way, William's question says, this might be a bit long, but I need to give my background. I'm 6'2", 92 kilograms. But lean-ish, they say, and 41 years old. Like many in my position, I used to always try to be as light as possible, and I would try and do one or two fasted rides a week at zone two. These would suck, and after only 1.5 hours, no, I'd hit the wall no matter how slow and easy I go.
Oh my God, that's so crazy.
But look, like the internet tells you it's not. It's like, you're going to feel amazing, right? And like ketones are going to explode and you're going to feel like power. And, you know, so
we had,
I don't blame him for thinking that it was going to work out well. Like, you know,
I know. And we have one of the
most some people
informative...
can do this. Somebody's listening to this right now that does this and they're like, I don't feel terrible, you know? So like, and I don't want to, you know, paint the broad stroke too far, but yeah, I get what you mean though, Ivy. Like when you look at it, like depriving yourself and doing this, like,
and we had one of the most informative nutrition episodes ever recently with Dr. Alex Larson. And even amidst all that, there's still people that are like, well, this works for me. This is what I do. You're wrong. And yeah, it's just it's so tricky. Like, yeah, you can do that, but how good do you really feel? Like, how much better could you feel? Anyways, sorry.
Yeah. Sometimes opportunity cost isn't recognized by ourselves. Like you're fine where you're at. And it's feeling like Sergio Sandoval, he's a friend of mine. We also did a Successful Athletes podcast with him. He got ready for Leadville and he was doing fasted rides in his preparation for Leadville. And he had a great performance. He was doing them because that's just when he could work out in the morning and it was inconvenient to eat. And he was like, well, I might as well layer some additional benefit because he had heard that it worked. After that, the next year, I believe, he started doing those rides not fasted and fueled. And he sent me messages like, oh my goodness, I can't believe the difference. He's like, I didn't feel bad before, but now I feel strong. Like it's just a huge difference. So sometimes it feels fine and we're getting improvement. It's just there's more that we could be doing and we just don't recognize it. Okay, so William says, he said these fasted rides didn't go well. And then he says, a year ago, after I had a very bad experience at a super tough event, a talk was extreme. And after listening to a lot of wisdom-filled Trainer Road podcasts, I changed my strategy. I fueled all my rides well, I stopped getting on the scale, and I ate good, nutritious food as much as I felt like. I was able to increase my volume from 8 hours per week to 13 hours per week, became a lot faster, and went back and smashed that Ataquas race.
Food good.
Way to go. Yeah, food good. This week I had a hectic week. Sunday evening, I ate light before bed. I overslept Monday morning, no breakfast. And just as I got out of the city for my 2 hour zone two ride, I realized I didn't bring any fuel and I decided to wing it. I ended up doing a 2 hour fasted ride and felt great. So my question is, did I somehow improve my fat substrate utilization by fueling more and just doing a lot more volume? Thank you for changing my cycling forever and for the best from William. That's awesome. Ivy, what are your first inclinations regarding this question of did I improve my fat substrate utilization by fueling more and just doing a lot more volume versus doing just the fasted rides? Because that's typically one of the goals of fasted rides is fasted rides, increase fat substrate utilization is kind of like a common goal with it.
Right, right. Well, armchair scientist, I had to Google that. I just know, like, in my experience with stuff like this, like, the same could kind of be applied to sleep, right? If you're in a constantly deprived state of sleep, it's much different than if you, like, get good sleep all the time and have one or two bad nights. You probably will still feel okay, right? And so I think William was probably definitely in a continuous depleted state prior. And now that, you know, they're constantly fueling and staying on top of it so much more, something like one outstanding ride, you know, the tank is topped off almost all the time because he's fueling so well all the time now. So I don't think one ride like this would make you feel the same way as you did when you were fast and riding all the time like that. But
yeah,
what do you think?
Yeah, I think, like, on a short answer side, yeah, you may be burning more net fat now, but it's likely perhaps like a minor portion of your substrate utilization. You were doing less work before, so less fuel was required. You're doing more work now, more fuel is required. You've trained yourself to use carbohydrate for that fuel, as some portion of it. And as a result, you're burning more carbohydrate likely than you were before. That's the most likely thing from this. However, because you're just doing more work, yeah, you may actually end up burning more fat. But in terms of shifting the ratio between fat and carbohydrate, I wouldn't think that it would be likely, unless, of course, now riding at whatever intensity you were riding at before, if you're riding at the same intensity now, your body might be so much stronger that it actually doesn't need to tap into carbohydrate quite as much. And as a result, you're just using more fat from it. Mm. And it's probably just worth us, like, kind of describing these basics, because somebody's hearing this for the first time. And I know for some of you, that seems like crazy that somebody would hear it for the first time, but we're all discovering things at different paces. And, you know, this is being listened to by hundreds of thousands of people. So there's a broad variety of spectrum or of perspectives here. So I want to just kind of go over that. And kind of like this question instantly comes in, like, should I be shooting for more performance or fat adaptation? And I kind of want to position it as that. And I know that some of you are probably upset by that because you're thinking that you can do both at the same time. What we've seen, and I just saw another study released in 2023 that was looking at, like, elite race walkers and doing like a ketogenic diet and looking at it. And there's quite a few studies, and one that I'll talk about here, that have tested this. And when you test it, it's always tricky to test these sort of things, but the majority of the research shows that it doesn't benefit endurance performance, particularly if it's anything that isn't very long, very low intensity. We're talking like multiple day sort of stuff. So anyways, that's the consensus of the research. And I know there are studies that show the opposite of that. Studies vary. So if you have those studies, share them down in the links below. I don't want to start like a study war or something, but I do think that we can have a civil conversation about it. So you should share them down below, in the comments on this YouTube video. Okay. So the theory behind fat adaptation is more fat oxidation, more glycogen sparing, and also more glycogen sparing then should equal greater performance potential. Basically, like, we have glycogen stored in our muscles, and if we run out of it, boom, we start to not perform as well. So this whole concept is, we have a lot of fat, why not use more fat? Maybe we can train our bodies to use more fat. And that's kind of like the whole point of reaching for fat adaptation. So if we could do that, spare glycogen for those important key efforts, and then as a result, we could have really good performance. So the goal is to increase your performance. And I think for all of us, our goal should just be to increase our performance in our cycling discipline of choice by using fat as a fuel source. That's like what you would want to accomplish with this. But there's kind of two ways to do this. Yeah, with fat adaptation. Right. Exactly. Okay. Yep. Yeah, exactly. All of us generally, we probably don't care about like what percentage of fuels we're using. We just want to do the work, right? And we want to be able to adapt from the work. And that's the main goal. But with fat adaptation, that's what you want to do. Thanks for the clarification, Ivy. So there's two main ways to do this though. And the first one is to reduce your carbohydrate intake through fasting or through restriction or through anything else like that to force fat out of oxidation. You could also supplement with ketones and try to make this happen. There's lots of different approaches that you can do. And the pros behind this is that science has proven that this does increase fat oxidation to a certain point, like it science has shown that does increase fat oxidation. The cons to this, however, is that performance potential is typically limited because your body, as it works harder, is designed to use carbohydrate as a fuel source to enable greater performance. So if you're depriving yourself of that, it just makes it so that you can't work as hard. The harder you can work, as long as you can recover from it, the faster you'll get, right? And that's like a very basic part of training that can't be broken. Another con from this is that, just on that point, adaptations are a lot tougher to achieve as recovery and performance is typically hindered. So clearly you can't work as hard, but also your body in that process of rebuilding, it needs energy to make that happen. And if you're going into a spot where you're depriving yourself of carbohydrate in particular, it makes it difficult for your body to recover. Also, in most ketogenic diets, they're typically they're very rich in fat, but also in protein. So I know protein rebuilds the muscles and it's good that you're getting that, but you also need carbohydrate to be able to give your body the energy it needs to be able to perform all the other tasks that it needs to do. So those are the cons with it. It's harder to get faster with, basically. Now there's another approach. You could increase your threshold. So your body doesn't have to use as much carbohydrate to hold a desired pace. Let's say that pace is 150 watts. And right now, you're in a situation where, let's just say you use 50-50, and these are all just, you know, silly numbers that I'm throwing out, 50-50 fat and carbohydrate. But suddenly you get really, really fit. You train really hard, you get faster. Now, as a result, if instead of having a 200 watt FTP, you're up at having a 300 watt FTP, 150 watts is a lot smaller percentage of your threshold. And as a result, it's lower intensity for your body in terms of a work rate. And your body now says, oh, I can actually use 75% fat and 25% carbohydrate at that level. The benefit of doing this, the pros, is that science has also proven that this does decrease reliance upon glycogen stores. As you get faster, you end up using less. It also allows your maximum performance in training because you're supplementing with carbohydrate. So you don't have to have that question of like, maybe I'm underfueled and underperforming. And then it aids instead of hinders your recovery, assuming that you're still taking in adequate amounts of protein, of course, as well, which typically is like 1.8 to 2.8 grams per kilogram of body weight. So the cons. Carbs are expensive, I guess. That's like fueling your work, you know, that's kind of the only one that I can come up with. Now, I know the other con though, that's going to come into people's minds is, well, I gain a lot of body fat by doing that, but we're not talking about eating candy all day. And we're not talking about, you know, like doing that. That's
unless
we're
talking you're me. About,
yeah. Like, honestly, the bike is the buffet, as Amber has said many times on this podcast, right? In the sense that like go out and you can take in the sort of carbohydrates that you need on the bike. Your body's burning that fast carbohydrate. So that's when those gummy bears are awesome, you know, and that sort of thing. That's when those gels are really helpful because your body is able to, it's not going to have an insulin response that it's in an active state, and it's going to use that fuel directly for energy for the muscles. That's awesome. Like, it's going to get it through the bloodstream and straight into things. When you're off the bike, it's about eating a lot of like a carb-rich diet as well, but it's, you know, we're talking whole grains, fruits and vegetables. And when it comes through those three main avenues, it's pretty tough, honestly, to like get to a point where you're going to be gaining excess body fat. But I do want to step back and talk about the term excess body fat. It's probably determined for all of us, at least I'll just speak for myself. That is absolutely determined by societal norms. Like, I look around and I believe subconsciously that I should have a certain amount of body fat because of what the world tells me. My body is going to find whatever the ideal state is. And that's my ideal state. It isn't what the world tells me. Like, if I'm fueling and I'm nourishing myself effectively and I'm driving toward performance, and when I'm off the bike, I'm eating lots of color, eating lots of variety, whole grains, fruits and vegetables, protein, like healthy fats, all this other stuff that's good. Like the basic food pyramid we learned about when we were kids, like back on the door in whatever class you were in. That is the sort of thing that if you're doing that and you're training and you're allowing yourself to recover, your body's going to find or be whatever it needs to be. And that's awesome. It has this mechanism and this ability to find balance. And that's like what we're really going for. Mm-hmm. So if your goal with fat adaptation is to look a certain way, I would challenge you to think about why you should look that way. Is it because you're going for performance, or is it because there's a lot of pressures that exist around us that are telling us how we should look, or how we should look on the bike, and as a result, how we should perform and how we should climb? or are we trying to drive performance and be the best, strongest version of ourselves? And when we change that to be our approach, I think it's really helpful. And fat adaptation is typically just always paired with those narratives of being lean for being lean's sake and for aesthetic purposes. And sometimes it's attached to having really long, like power and your ability to be able to endure really long things. And that's awesome. I just question once again, if deprivation is a necessary part of that, or if you could still just, you know, use a lot of fat just by getting stronger on the bike. So there's a study that I want to send people to, and then Ivy, I want to hear any closing thoughts you have on this, but it's called low carbohydrate, high fat diet impairs exercise economy and negates the performance benefit from intensified training in elite race walkers. This is from Burke and colleagues back in 2016. There's a 2023 version of this study that I think just came out, and I'm not sure how available it is in certain journals for people to access. But it's also, and I say a version, it's a similar study to this. And yeah, it's like it's just corroborating the same findings. A quick summarizing of this. The study involved elite race walkers. They followed either a high carbohydrate availability diet or a periodized carbohydrate diet, switching between high and low carb intake for 3 weeks. While undergoing intensified training, despite increasing fat metabolism, the low carbohydrate, high fat diet did not improve performance. So this is a great example of the fact that like you can get to the point where you burn more fat, but is that driving performance? And isn't that our end goal? Like just to do more on the bike, because that makes the bike more enjoyable. So those are, sorry, Ivy, you asked my thoughts and I kind of went on, but
no, it's awesome.
Hopefully that explains kind of the premise behind this and gives people a balanced perspective behind that. So I don't know whatever the thoughts you have on it, but
I just love to see us. Love to see you, John, fighting stereotypes of what cyclists or athletes should look like, you know. And I think that's changing a lot in cycling culture. Maybe, you know, 10 or 15 years ago when I started riding, there was totally this standard or perception that like skinny is fast, right? And I feel like that's changed quite a bit across disciplines too. Like it's really cool to just see like high level athletes have a lot of different body compositions and be on the same level of competition, you know, at the same competing in the same way. And that's just so great and definitely helps me when, you know, I wonder about these fat adaptation athletes too and what their goal is, if it is appearance stuff and body composition stuff. And I know it's really cool for me to like see an athlete that I'm sure is calorie deprived and, you know, not nourishing the way they should. And if I feel like bad about myself as a result, like it's really nice to be able to step back and be like, you know what, that guy, there's no way he can do what I do, you know? Being nourished is cool.
Yeah, it is. I have this totally unproven and unscientific theory, but I'd be curious about hearing people's thoughts on it. Why are we seeing more athletes of varying body compositions and body types succeed at the high levels of the sport? If you look at mountain biking, we have a broad spectrum in the men's and the women's fields. If you look at triathlon, we have it in the long course field in particular. We have it. If you look in women's road racing and men's road racing, we even see it. For a long time, we saw like a kind of like monolithic, like or like monolithic isn't the right word. We saw this like one-sided like view of like, this is what an athlete looks like. And now we're seeing more. And my theory behind this is because we've made so many advances in fueling, like in athletes fueling their training and their work. And as a result, you're allowed to see an athlete that may not look just like insanely lean with Saran wrap for skin. You're now seeing athletes that look totally different succeed because instead of everybody reaching for that being the gold standard of being super lean, people are reaching toward performance with nourishment. And as a result, we've now enabled a lot of different type of people to be successful at this. That's my theory. I have zero science to back that up, but I'm curious what other people think, because we're certainly, it's a change. Like look now compared to 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And it seems like the further back you go in time, the more similar everybody looked. And now everybody looks a bit different. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts? Am I wrong? I'd be curious to know. All right, let's go into the next question from Deep. It says, Hey guys, love the podcast and keep up the great work. I'm going to participate at the Charlevoix Grand Prix in Cat 3. It takes place on June 9th, 10th, and 11th in Quebec, Canada. Stage 1 is a crit. Stage 2 is an individual time trial on day 2 morning. And then stage 3 is a hill climb on the same day in the evening. The last stage is on the third day and is a 127-kilometer road race with a 1,600 meters of climbing with a hill climb in it. So how do I go about preparing for this? I'm in the first week of specialty on Trainer Road. I did a lot more TSS than recommended. Yikes. Ivy, you can't see.
Sorry.
Ivy's rubbing her eyes already. Would it have a detrimental effect on my freshness for the race, doing that extra TSS? Also, how do I navigate recovery between stages, which is probably going to be a deciding factor? Some stats of mine, most recent FTP of 285, my weight of 61 kilograms gives me a power to weight ratio of 4.67. So very strong, very, very fat, very strong in terms of watt kg athlete. Thanks from deep. Ivy, there's a few things to unpack. How they go about preparing for it, the doing too much TSS and if that's going to hinder them going into the race, and then how to navigate recovery between the stages. But your experience with stage races, I feel like this is in your wheelhouse. Right. Where do you want to go with this first?
Well, deep is strong, and I know why this is happening. You're in your specialty phase and the training worked. It obviously worked. You're strong. Your watts per kg are high. And you get in the specialty phase and all of a sudden you have this newfound fitness that you get excited about using. And so it's really easy to want to add in fun rides, add intensity, do an extra set of intervals because you feel so good. But this is not the time, especially is not the time to make more gains and build more fitness. It is the time that you can undo what you've done, though, by doing too much going into your event. You can absolutely do too much intensity, too much volume to not recover and prepare the way you should for that race. And so how do you prepare for this? Like Plan Builder and Adaptive Training did it for you, you know? It took you there and built you up before specialty. And now specialty is a time where you're supposed to really just sharpen the blade. And there are, you know, it's not a recovery period by any means. There are tough structured workouts in there, but it's not the time to really press and add volume and build a bunch. It's the time to sharpen the blade. And so how to prepare? Follow the plan. don't add more TSS than what's assigned. I mean, if you want to add like a chill ride with friends, as long as you're able to stay on top of recovery and it's not like a handful of extra hours, you know, stuff like that's okay. But yes, it could have a detrimental effect on your on the freshness for the race, like you asked. Yes, it could if you do too much. So please don't do that. How do I navigate recovery?
One thing on that quick, Ivy, that I want to share. This is really hard for me because like right now the trails are drying out and like they're not muddy anymore. And I want to go do big days on the bike. But I have single track 6 coming up and I'm just getting into my specialty phase. And what I'm doing is I'm saving it all up. So it's as like a reward. And I don't know if this helps for other people, but this doesn't mean I'm just like, you know, laser focused, not having any fun. I'm still having fun. Like I'm doing when I can, I'm doing intervals and spots where I can descend a trail in between for my rest interval. And then on Saturdays, I'm following a lower volume plan. I think a mid volume plan right now. And instead of doing high volume for me, I'm like a higher level athlete that can tolerate that sort of stuff typically. But I've selected a lower volume. And then Saturdays are my day to go out and do my mountain bike rides, but I'm still throttling those back. Like I'm not letting myself just go out and blow myself up. So I'm saving it up and it's like a big treat for after my goal race that I have waiting for me. And I'm really excited to do it. And then I'll get to use that awesome fitness that I've built and it'll be really fun to go do that stuff. So that's one thing that I'm doing to help myself avoid that temptation.
And you're not going to lose fitness. This is a really important thing too. Just because your volume or the intensity of your workouts is changing does not mean you are losing fitness by any means.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, I have some KOMs that I'm planning on taking after this. I'm so excited for. Like, I'm going to like, I can't wait to go and get those. That's awesome. Good motivation for me to kind of keep the nose to the grindstone and be diligent and not just blow my training up with excess stuff.
That's great. Okay. How do I navigate recovery between the stages? I think the biggest thing for a race like this, when you have multiple stages in one day and, you know, a stage the night before, I feel like preparing for meals is the biggest thing that helps me recover on days like this. So, not waiting until you are done with that first stage on the double day to be like, oh no, I should eat. Make sure to do it before the second stage with plenty of time. What should I eat? Where can I eat? I'm in a different town. What should I do? Like, get a little mini rice cooker wherever you're staying. Like, bring a Tupperware, bring a little lunch, like a cooler box. Make sure that you don't. That's been the biggest thing for recovery for me on stage races or multiple hard days, is making sure I have food available like immediately after a ride and not waste any time looking around or driving around or wondering what to eat and then waiting to order and waiting to get food. That really puts me under when I'm trying to stay on top of recovery. It sounds silly, but even like waiting an hour and a half to drive to order, wait for food, can totally derail me.
Or even cook it, right? Like in the sense of like, you know, you got to stay on your feet and then, you know, keep track of a lot of things that are being cooked and going on. That's not an ideal way to recover either. I like your idea of having it done beforehand. I'm planning on single track six, Ivy. In some cases, you know, we'll be camping in like, in one specific case, in a remote area with like no anything around us. I'm planning on getting a bunch of minute rice. So it's like, I can microwave it for like 90 seconds. And I think the van that I'm going to have, it has a microwave, I think. I'll have to double check. It might not. If not, then I'm not going to do minute rice, but I'm just going to be able to basically, I'm going to cook a big amount of rice and then I'm going to be able to do it the night before and then I'll eat it the next day. But that's like a big thing for me. And it may not be your most exciting meal right after the race either, right, Ivy? But it's just, it's getting your body what it needs, and that's okay.
I'm totally going to rely upon dehydrated food a little bit. I'll bring my camping stove, my little jet boil, and they like mango sticky rice packs.
Nice.
They just pour hot water in and takes, you know, 5 or 6 minutes to cook up. Easy.
I should start testing a lot of those meals that you can get. Like I don't know if they're freeze dried meals. I think they are. Like I think like Mountain Man or something like that. I can't remember the name of them. But there's like a bunch of different brands.
This brand, Peak something, that you can get at like REI or I think a lot of backpacking or outdoor places have them. And there's like 1800 or 2000 calories in a bag of that stuff. And it's
amazing.
Tasty. It's good. It's so good. Yeah, I love it.
Peak Refuel, Backpackers Pantry, Mountain House. Those are three brands that I'm seeing right now. I need to go get some and then try them.
Is it tasty or is it like perfect, like preparing food on your own? Like, no, it's not perfect, but like whatever, you know? For the sake of getting good calories in quick, it's awesome.
I think one of the greatest things about Cape Epic, there's so many great things. It's an incredible race. But when you finish that race, Woolworths is like a common grocery chain there and they sponsor it. And right after you finish, you go into the Woolworths tent and they have like a selection of microwave meals that you can pick from that are actually quite good. Like if you hadn't just finished a Cape Epic stage, like you said, Ivy, it might not be the most tasty thing, but they were great right after the stage. And I think that was really key to us. Like we were still in dirty kit. They would bring us towels to like dry off and stuff. But before we did that, we were already eating a meal. And I think that that's like a huge thing that you have to do for sure. And also between races on days like that, keep it really low on fat, right? That would be like a big goal for me at least.
Yeah. Super simple. Rice dishes. Yeah. Some vegetables, not a big old steak or something.
Yeah. I'd probably even cut out if it's like in between one stage to the other in the same day, I wouldn't even have veggies. Like I'll have rice and maybe like a bit of egg in there, but then again, that's kind of high in fat, but I don't know, like a bit of it. Maybe some chicken if you have, that would be great. Cause it's going to be really low on fat and just a small amount, but that's what I would do. Like I would just like low fiber and just, you know, give my body the essentials. So yeah. This other question about, then when they're talking about the recovery between the stages though, it's not just about nutrition, What should he do in between? Because it'd be easy to like, I think maybe I need to stay frosty out there and go like pedal around or do something else in between the stages. What are your recommendations there on the same day?
Oh my gosh. Don't go, you know, it's a crit. So I'm sure there'll be other crits throughout the day. Don't sit in the hot sun to watch your friend's race. I know you want to, but like, if you want to be at the race venue, make sure you're in the shade, like able to put your feet up or lay down. If it's really hot, don't like go back to your hotel or homestay and get in the AC and take a nap, you know? And then I would say like, don't do a really big warm up before that second stage. You don't need to, like your legs are open. I love days like that. It's so awesome. You like barely need to warm up. You just kind of like spin around and you're like, yep, I'm back. I'm there again. It's easy.
Ready to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Good advice. Awesome. Henry's question. A question about tire selection. What are the considerations running different tires front and rear? I first thought of this after putting a pair of 42 millimeter S-Works Pathfinders on my gravel bike, which ride great on a mixture of surfaces I mostly ride, but turn out to have insufficient clearance on the rear, rubbing on the seat tube after picking up any dirt. So I'm considering keeping the front, but swapping out the rear for a similar tread, but a smaller size at 38 millimeters. This made me think this choice might also make sense for performance, since I'd rather back starts, the back starts sliding before the front goes. So, how do mismatched tires affect handling, and what pairings should work well? If for anybody familiar with like motocross or supercross, one of the greatest of all time, James Stewart, an incredible rider, revolutionized the sport. His dad used to always say, "Is really funny." He used to say, I believe it was front tire slip, back end kick, or maybe it was the other way around, back tire slip, front end kick. But anyways, like there's this assumption that somehow they operate fully independently from each other and they don't. Like I know that you would want the back end to slide beforehand, but the back end sliding then puts more importance on the front end having traction. So what you're really doing is by starting your back end to slide, you're then saying, okay, so absolutely everything depends on my front tire now. And in most cases, your front tire probably isn't up to that task. You have to have a lot of bike skill to be able to compensate for that. So I know that's kind of like the losing the front first is less ideal than losing the back first. I know it's more savable, but why resort to losing one first or the other? Instead, I would advocate for just not losing traction being a better option for it. Mm-hmm. Ivy, this is like your wheelhouse with the cyclocross too. You're always having to make these like tire choice decisions. But then again, I guess you're kind of governed by 32 millimeters, but.
Right. But that doesn't mean that I won't choose, tread accordingly. Right. So like one time there was an issue with equipment and flats and I had to have mismatched tires. And so the rear was like a mid tread. It was a muddier day. They're tubeless, so I can switch them around. They're not, tubulars. It's not like I would have to re-glue anything. So I could just be like, okay, which wheel, what do I do? And I would put the heavier tread, the mud tire on the front and do the lower profile tread on the back when I had to. I guess I hadn't like considered that before I raced cyclocross because I, like Henry, kind of considered or thought that, you know, your rear slips out first. Like that's where the drivetrain and all the force is going, that's where you should have more traction. But that didn't feel like the case when I did that for cyclocross. And then like for the mountain bike, I had similar clearance issues to Henry where I could only run a like 2.2 in the rear. But that wasn't quite enough. It still isn't quite enough for the kind of riding I want to do. And so I have a 2.4 in the front. It's like, oh, this is great, you know, to have like a little more traction in the front. And I don't feel like one goes before the other, you know? And so I wonder why athletes feel like that happens. Is it because you're grabbing a handful of the rear brake all the time, you know?
Like, yeah. And that is like, and for sure, if you're going to lose one, you know, like the rear is what you want to lose first. Also, I think this is right. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. I'm probably wrong on this, but I believe that it's 70% roughly of your weight is distributed over the rear wheel versus 30% on the front when you're in a seated position. And as a result, that rolling resistance on the rear matters more because you have more weight pressing into it, more force. probably wrong. Engineers, tell me why I'm wrong. But anyways, that's typically where what people have. So like having that faster rolling tire in the back is more common for people because it's on the front. You want to have the traction on the rear. You want to have fast rolling. So it is a common strategy. If you're going, the big thing that I've noticed though, is that you want to have similar handling characteristics front to back. And typically what that's going to be decided by is two main things. And when I say handling characteristics, I'm talking about handling characteristics when poop is hitting the fan, when things are going sideways. You want to know that you want to know how your tires are going to react. So that's typically decided by the side knobs, the shoulder knobs, sometimes they're called. They're the ones that are furthest out to the sides. How prominent are they? If you're in a situation where you're picking like a slick or something like that, you want to have one with some prominent side knobs if you're going to be sliding around or leaning over hardened turns. If your front tire and rear tire don't have similar side knobs and don't have a similar gap and channel in between the center knobs and the side knobs, they're going to react very differently in those scenarios that matter a lot. And the tricky part about that is that your front might catch, and then your front catching, your rear might not be ready to catch. And as a result, it causes this weird timing mismatch. So I've seen this a lot where people will run something like on mountain biking, and I'll use Maxxis tires because they're familiar. But you might be running something like a DHF, a Minion DHF up front, and then you might be running something like an Icon in the rear. And those two tires could not be more different. A DHF is basically
like an Aspen or something on the rear. Yeah.
Like a DHF could not be, it has like 17 layers of safety nets. Like it will not let you fall. It really wants to give you traction. And the Icon does not have any sort of prominence in their side knobs, and they're evenly spaced all throughout. So that DHF is going to give you a really clear indication of when it's locked in and when you can't lean anymore. That Icon is going to give you zero indication. As a result, you have two very differently behaving tires front to back. And the best way to match this is, of course, match the tires front to rear regardless of size. And if you can't do that and you're going to mix and match, then in that case, you at least want to have similar side knobs and a similar channel in between the side knobs and the knobs in the center. If you do those two things, it can give you similar handling characteristics, so you wouldn't have to worry about mixing and matching.
Henry should be more concerned if you tried to find also a 42 that would work in the back because it had a different side knob profile, so it fit a little bit differently. That would concern me more to do both 42s with different profiles than it would to do a 42 in the front and a 38 in the rear that had the same tread profile. I don't know if Henry's going to notice a huge difference if it's the same tread.
Yep, I agree. And it's totally adequate to do that. I did that on my gravel bike for a long time of running a fatter tire up front and a skinnier tire in the rear because of clearance issues. Ideally, you'd have on a rigid bike, if you're riding rough terrain, a bigger tire back there because that would make it more comfy, but you won't. So that's what you'll notice. But other than that, the tires will handle similarly. The only extreme cases is if you have really narrow or really wide rims. And then if you have a really wide or narrow tire, it can change the way that tire behaves substantially because instead of being shaped like an arc, it can be shaped kind of like a flat, like a U almost across the top instead of something like a point. So that can change it. But in most cases, like Ivy said, you're dialed in. Just if you're mixing and matching with tire tread types, try to match the side knobs as close as you can. A great example of this is like on mountain biking, Maxxis has the Recon and Recon Race. Similar side knobs, intentionally so, and that can be helpful. The Ardent and Ardent Race, but I don't recommend that anybody ever run the Ardent as a front tire because it's terrifying. Race is a bit better, but the Ardent is just going to let go and never tell you about it. So it's kind of a sketchy one. But there's good examples of tires from different brands like that. I think a Vittoria has a lot of options like that too, where they have like their Terreno Dry, and then their Terreno, I think, is like slightly different in terms of the knobs and stuff. So anyways, lots of options. Try to match the side knobs. Ross's question, last one. Hey guys, love the podcast and the Train Road platform. My bunch ride plays a drinking game every time someone brings up your podcast. I hope that you guys are safe, but also hope that you guys hope lots of people are talking about it. So my question is, and also on that note, share this podcast, rate it, please. If you're listening to this right now, give it a thumbs up on YouTube. If you're watching it, share it with other people. That is huge. And that's how you help us continue to build great things here at Train Road. My question is around my A race, Road Nationals. While Trainer Road is doing a fantastic job of building my fitness on the low volume program, I might add, I'm starting to think of the course and specific training I can do to prepare myself for it through my build and specialty phase. The course is a circuit with a key 8 to 9 minute climb being the point in which the selection is made each year as the field gets thinned with each lap. The climb is then followed by 10 minutes of undulating downhill to complete the lap, which is then repeated for roughly 2 hours. Knowing my previous races, as well as putting the course into best bike split, my goal is to average 130% of my FTP for these climbs. Holy cow.
Yikes.
130% for 8 to 9 minutes. Ross, either your FTP, either you should use AI FTP detection, or you are a physiological freak. If you're able to repeat 130% for 8 to 9 minutes and do that 12 times. I would be thinking that you would be looking for 8 to 9 minutes. You'd be looking somewhere around 105 to 110%, maybe. But then, but, you know, that would be max.
There's also a reason why it doesn't matter, which we'll get into.
Good foreshadowing. I agree. But first of all, I think the 130% thing is not correct. I would blow up long before that. 130% is really hard to maintain. So Ross continues, my first thought to prepare for this course is to practice these 8 to 9 minute climb efforts at the target power. But when I recreate the course power plan, your workout creator is saying that the workout is an eye-watering level 15 for VO2 max. Yep, that's understandable. Like I said, Ross, if you were to do 12 by that, that would be insane. So it shouldn't be possible with an accurate FTP. So use AI FTP detection, check that out. So I'm thinking and hoping that there is an easier or different way to train and prepare for these 8 to 9 minute efforts. While VO2 max is my strong point, a level 15 workout makes me question my sanity and my commitment to cycling. Keep up the good work. I downloaded Apple Podcasts just to give you 5 stars, as I already have done so on Spotify. Thank you so much. That is amazing. We appreciate it, Ross. And if you, and rating on Spotify is probably the best spot to help us, by the way. So if you've rated it on one platform, but not on Spotify, go to it there. That's huge. Cause that's where most people find their podcasts these days. So, my only thought is 130% for 8 minutes. Please don't die. That's my thought. That sounds terrible. Ivy.
Oh my goodness. Ross. Oh, for a race like this, instead of thinking about what is optimal for you to perform well, like you should for maybe a time trial or something or an individual effort, instead think about what you should try to avoid in order to prevent yourself from absolutely cracking wide open before the end of this race. So for me, in a group race like this, that would look like even just by riding RPE, I would know or want to go into a race with the plan like, whatever the group is doing, if I go too far into the red the first couple times up this climb, I won't make it. And adjust your strategy accordingly. Sag climb, if there's a huge descent, if you have to let them go by a handful of bike lengths and trust that you'll make it up on the descent in order to stay out of the red, try it. But do not shoot for 130% for 8 minutes a handful of times. And that's why like best bike split isn't great for group dynamic races, because what if you're on the front on the first time up that climb and you had this strategy of I'm going to do 130% and you did it and the other people either let you go or because it's insane or followed you and you ended up getting dropped the very next time because that goal was too high, right? You could be climbing the first few times up and they could be only doing 75 or 80% of what you think you should be doing because they know how big the day is. And that's a time where you need to respond and follow the pace of the race and just be like, great, this is just more matches that I can save that I can use later. So I appreciate your dedication to looking at this kind of data before a race. But in a group dynamic race, when anything can happen out there, especially on a climb that long, when you really need to respond to other riders, you just need to trust that the training you've done has prepared you. Don't pin yourself into this plan of this is how many watts I need to do and this is how I'm going to win. I've never seen a rider take that approach in a group race that has successfully done that, unless it's like there's one climb at the end and I'm going to save everything. And then I know I can know I can do this many watts at the end for this long. And I'm going to try for that. You know, this isn't that kind of setting. What do you think, John?
I agree. Yeah, really good advice on like the execution side of things. On the training side of things, that what I would add is that you can change your VO2 max workouts to be the type that is called, there's a workout profile called long supra threshold. And what those are going to do is that's going to have you working at somewhere around that like 6 to even 12 in the really long cases, but 6 to 12 minutes at like low percentages of VO2 max. Like I said, more sustainable ones around like 105% and ticking up, maybe up to 110, but that would be really hard. Those can be a pretty specific way to give you some confidence. And whatever VO2 max workout you have, you could swap that over and you could just use your progression levels. Let's say you're level 5, just find a level 5 VO2 max long super threshold workout and you can do that. So that's one option that you could do. But I would caution you against thinking that like doing very specific preparation is going to prepare you for the race in that regard, particularly with road racing. If it's a time trial, it's different. Like you can do something that replicates things a bit more closely and that can be beneficial. And that's a strategy that a lot of people use. However, I still think it's best to focus on training the energy system most effectively. And that's going to deliver the best performance on race day. But man, like Ivy pointed out, who knows how that race is going to unfold. They might go super hard on lap one and then laps 2, 3, 4, and 5. It's dead easy. Mm-hmm. And then as a result, you'll find yourself in this situation of being like kind of like insecure because you've built this entire framework in your mind around this is how the race should go. It should be X percent up this climb every time. And now that it's not, I feel disoriented and I don't know how to react. And that's a danger. Yep.
And this is athletes write in all the time about how do I pick a plan for this race? And why are these workouts here for an event like this? And the answer is situations like this. Just because an 8 or 9 minute climb would be in that like super threshold zone doesn't mean that's like you could be doing tempo the first few times up the climb and then absolutely in the red bonkers so much higher than threshold the last couple times because people are actually racing. And what if you put yourself in that category of like, no, this is the race I'm doing, or I'm never going to do a race that has a really hard punchy short climb, so this is the training I'm doing, and then you're not prepared. There's so much value in training all of those systems and knowing and trusting that you've prepared all of those systems accordingly to respond to whatever happens on a race day in a group scenario or alone. Like even if it's a time trial or an individual effort, the wind can change, the weather can change. Look at Unbound. What if you're like Unbound, I only have to do zone 2 stay around here for 12 hours. Like I guarantee you there were many, many, many moments that were much harder than tempo or threshold that you had to be above there and like you have to recover from it, you know?
Yep. It's good to be flexible in terms of what you're prepared for physically and also psychologically. And that's what your plan is likely going to be building for you, particularly on the rolling road race or climbing road race plans. I assume that's what Plan Builder gave you for this sort of event. It's really going to prepare you for dealing with dynamic racing, which is a really important thing to keep in mind. So hopefully that gives you the advice that you need there. So once again, you can look for those long super threshold ones and do those occasionally, but don't make your training just that one single profile and make it all one single shade of a specific color. Allow variety because that's going to make you well prepared for your event. Then, like Ivy said, in the race, be ready to read that field and roll with the punches. Watch our race analysis videos on YouTube if you haven't. That's a great resource that you can use to be able to train up your racing eye, so to speak, and your racing acumen to be able to recognize opportunities and recognize our bad opportunities. Like, there's lots of my race footage where you can see that exemplified quite well. So, you can check that out and train your eyes beforehand. So then when you're in the race, you can recognize it.
And then go practice it.
Good luck. Yeah. It's fun to practice it, right? Go out there and try beforehand and race the folks. So yeah, absolutely. Ivy, thanks. This has been fun.
Thanks, John.
If people are listening to this podcast right now, you can go to trainerroad.com and sign up and become faster like so many people here. Go check out the reviews on the App Store. There's like over 16,000 reviews and it's a 4.9 star average. That's astounding. Like that's far above average for an app, particularly a trading app. It's amazing. So go check it out. It works. It makes you faster. Use adaptive training, use AI FTP detection, and don't take tests anymore. It's amazing. You don't have to do it. It'll analyze your outdoor rides and recognize when it's going up, even your unstructured ones. It's super cool. And stay tuned. We're working hard on getting adaptive training to be for all of you, because internally we're using it and refining it. And going into a big meeting on it actually after this, but stay tuned, because soon adaptive training, I don't know what soon means in terms of relativity, but adaptive training will also be breaking down and giving you appropriate credit for every single one of your rides, structured or unstructured, and regardless of context. It's all exciting stuff. It's a good time to sign up for Trainerobe. All right, everybody, talk to you next week. Thanks. Bye.